I came in here last week and tried to move all the tables around so that everybody can see all three boards. I think that's true for most seats, although maybe part of this board is invisible to some of you. I'll try to avoid that. There's a few seats at the other end. If you can't see everything, you can try moving the other end. Let me know if you can't see something so I can just avoid that spot.
So I'm putting everything on a web page.
If you go to Blackboard for this course, what you'll see is basically a link to this web page. So that's where I'm going to put the board photos, the lecture audio. You may have already seen an email about this. You may have already seen an email about the syllabus. So does everyone have a copy of the syllabus?
No.
Okay. Did everyone get a copy of the homework?
I didn't.
Are there any extra copies out there?
Did they all get it?
Yeah. Okay, who else needs Okay. If you turn to the second sheet, so page 3 of the syllabus, you'll see how I have the schedule. I can't predict with 100% certainty the topics we'll cover, but this should be close to the reality. And you'll see that I count days. So this is day 1. Monday will be day 2. Next Wednesday will be day 3. So day 5 is 2 weeks from now. That's September 7th. That's when this first homework is due. And let's see. What was that? Do you all have a copy of this in your syllabus?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. I don't know how that got in there. That's just something from some math research I was doing with a graduate student. Anyways, well, I guess it's a free sheet of paper for you. It doesn't have anything to do with this course. It has something to do with Boolean algebra, so you can forget that. Sorry. Okay. So yeah. So that brings it down to 6 pages. All right. So, I put a lot of information about how the homework should be run. So you may have already gotten a chance to read this. If not, make sure you carefully read what I have to say about the homework. Are there any questions about the organization of the course? If you have a question later, feel free to interrupt me. That's fine. Daniel, did you get these?
I have a copy of the syllabus.
So, first thing I wanted to talk about was the reels aren't real, not really. Because you won't find them in the physical world. They're ideas. No one has all the digits of pi. Maybe God does, but I don't have all the digits of pi. You don't have all the digits of pi. Right? It's an idea. The physical world gives us approximations of that idea. Okay. And what we do here in the real world is we work with approximations. And the difference between calculus and advanced calculus is here we look a lot more closely at these approximations. The difference in a nutshell is that we are looking at the approximations. So I'll say a little bit more about what that's like.
So advanced calculus compared to calculus
has one thing it has is more inequalities, less equality. When you're talking about approximations, you say stuff like the error is smaller than 10 to the minus 5, things like that. You don't talk as much about, well, this is exactly equal to that. And with approximations, there's the problem of, well, when are we close enough? And when do we need to make the approximation better? Is that approximation of pi good enough for your purposes? Probably. There might be other situations where it's not. If you're doing something that was hyper-accurate in some very fancy physics experiment or something, or if you just wanted to show off and get more digits, whatever. So think back to calculus 2, sequences and series.
Excuse me, is this cognitive psychology?
I'm afraid not. The syllabus, you'll see that we spend, I don't know, the first half of the course, all on sequences. We're gonna get to the first week of October, and we'll still be doing sequences and series, right? A series, as you remember from calculus 2, is just a sequence of partial sums. You just add more and more numbers. Because how do we approximate a real number? With better and better with approximations in sequence. You're most familiar with decimal approximation sequences. Here's pi getting better and better in approximate form. And oh yes, look at my little checklist there. Remember, and proofs. That's the difference between a lower level math course and upper level math course. An upper level math course, you spend a lot more time actually proving stuff is true. One issue with sequences is this sequence, as you can see, it goes on forever.
So
you can't check every term in the sequence and try and prove anything about that term. The only way you could prove something about all terms is to find some kind of argument that somehow automatically works for all terms. Right? So for example, you could, with that sequence there, as long as it always starts with 3 point something, you could trivially say, well, if the limit exists, it's got to be positive, because every term in the sequence is at least 3. You know, if you have some argument that proves every term is at least 3. But if you, from some kind of general hypothesis, you prove general facts. But the point is, you have to prove it. You have to have some kind of argument. You can't just say, well, I checked something on my calculator, and you know, the first 10 terms or whatever are all good. Or even, I did a computer program, and the first 1,000,000 terms are all good. Now, for practical purposes, you know, you're doing some kind of, I don't know, engineering problem, physics problem. Maybe just checking the first 10 terms or whatever is good enough. It's probably going to stay the way you saw it in the first 10 terms. The real benefit of a proof is not so much being extra sure that something is true. It's that it explains why something is true. That's what math is all about to me. Explaining why the patterns we see are there. Right? You find some pattern, you think it's going to be true forever, no matter how far out you go into this sequence, and you check some terms. It looks like it's going to be true for you know, every term you care to look. I bet it'll keep being true, but you want to know, why is this happening? And that's what a proof really does. That's its value beyond just making you extra sure. It tells you why. And in the syllabus, I talk a lot about homework, mostly in the context of, okay, you're going to get asked to write proofs. And so I have some stuff in here about what should you do when you write a proof in terms of some kinds of things to avoid, and working groups. If you get help from an outside source, what do you do with that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So especially note,
did you get this?
No, okay.
Especially note that I'm going to give you a chance to revise your homework. I haven't done that in past years. I'm going to try it this year. So when this homework is due, what you turn in will be version 1. And when I return it back to you, then you'll have a limited time to revise it. So, after I grade and return your assignment to you, you have the option to submit one revision due 3 class days, which is usually a week and a half after I return your first version, or due on the last class day, whichever comes first. If you submit a revision, its grade will be averaged with your grade the first version. For most of you, I suspect writing a significant proof is a rather new experience. I'm going to try and ease you into it as much as possible. Now, one of the prerequisites for this course is discrete math. So you should have had some experience writing some little proofs. Yes? Mm-hmm. It's not entirely new. Proofs here will get a little bit more demanding. The trickiest part of this homework here will be 2B, because you're going to have to do some algebra to bring some fractions together and collect like terms to prove that something is greater than or equal to 0. But If you don't get it the first time around, you'll get a second chance. And since you've taken discrete math, and since you're here listening to what I'm saying and watching what I'm writing, in theory, you could get by without a textbook, but I really do not recommend trying that. I think in practice, you'll really want to refer to this book to reinforce what I say, and it's very cheap. It's $15. Questions or comments?
Is that book on the syllabus?
Yes, it is. I put a link to a web page about to the author's web page about the book on here too, so you can go there and follow the link. If you just search Amazon for it, you'll find it because the author uses a CreateSpace, which is a self-publishing platform which Amazon owns, and so you can buy it off of Amazon for $15. You would know better than I if the bookstore is selling it at the moment.
Yeah, I think it was
there. Yeah.
They sell? Yeah, it was there.
Good.
I don't know if they're sold out, but they'll be there.
Okay. So, I think I can do something. I wanted to show you something about how, what do I mean when I say reels aren't real? This thing keeps logging out or something. The trust relationship between this workstation and the primary domain failed. Well, that doesn't sound good. Okay. Maybe I'm not going to show you something on this screen. I'll get some technical help.
Can you clean it up?
Oh, you want to take it?
I kind of know what, like, I think about it.
Well,
the projector on or?
Let's see. Can you log into this machine, basically? Because I tried to log into it, and it gave me this error message I've never seen before.
No, I don't remember the credentials for that. Okay.
And I think you could log in with your own credentials if you want. Yeah, if it doesn't work, then we'll call for help. What I want to demonstrate is not essential, but be nice. I like to show stuff on a spreadsheet. It's a little easier to see than just than doing something on a calculator. What I can do, take some pictures of those two boards in the meanwhile.
Oh, it worked.
You logged in?
No, it doesn't work for me on here.
Okay, it doesn't work for you. Yeah, I think it's lost its network connection or something. Was it?
If I turn my skin at one. Oh, no, it doesn't. Yeah. My bad. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's a network problem. Sorry about that little delay there. Okay. All right. some sequence stuff. Okay. I'm going to try and use the same notation as the book. So the book will write stuff like this. Okay. What this means is an infinite list of numbers. A list that has a start but no end. Okay. Usually when we write n in this course, we mean a natural number, or a whole number. Some people say stuff like the natural numbers start at 1, the whole numbers start at 0. Whatever. Starting at 0, and then what you get by adding 1. The counting numbers starting at 0. Okay, now the thing here is, of course, it's a subscript, right? So we're not multiplying a by 0. This is really a kind of weird function notation where 0 is an input to a function a, 1 is another input, 2 is another input, 3 is another input to this function a. And when I write a subscript 3, I mean the output of this function when 3 is input. Well, that would be a little bad. I divide by 0. You can start at a different number. That's fine. Okay. Now, there are sometimes where you'll see in the book abbreviations that happen, how should I put it there? Abbreviations that assume even more context. Sometimes you might see something in the book where they just write this. The author, Professor Maddox, just writes that. The idea is you look at this and you say, okay, it's supposed to be a sequence, and well, what n can you plug into this, where n is a whole number and inputting that n makes sense? Well, in this example, it doesn't make sense to input a 0. But starting at 1, it makes sense. So that's what it could mean. You just have to get used to the context. Sequences are infinite. They start wherever it makes sense for them to start. Assume they start at 0. Unless that doesn't make sense, right? So, for n squared is fine for starting at 0. Functions written in a funny way. Your function here takes inputs that are whole numbers starting at 0, and its outputs are obtained by squaring those numbers. So the sequence of all outputs, right, is just this big list, all the square numbers starting at 0. Now, next thing we look at are properties of sequence.
Okay, so a sequence is increasing if you have this inequality. Each term is greater than or equal to the term that came before. Term is strictly greater than the term that came before. Okay, just terminology. We have to agree on what our terminology is, otherwise it's just boring terminology. That's just the importance of establishing some common language here. And you have similarly decreasing. Just turn it around. Each term needs to be less than or equal to the term that came before. For strictly decreasing, each term in the sequence needs to be strictly less than what came before. Nothing earth-shattering there. Just some terminology. Okay. So, in our terminology here, how would you describe this sequence? The reciprocal sequence. It's decreasing, that's true. It's also strictly decreasing. Yeah. And the square sequence is
strictly increasing.
It would be correct to say it's increasing. It would also be correct to say it's strictly increasing. The advantage of saying strictly increasing is that it gives you more information, right? If I just say it's increasing, then I'm allowing for the possibility that maybe some terms repeat. But if I say strictly increasing, then I'm making a much stronger promise. I'm saying not only does it never get smaller, but it never repeats either. So this is strictly decreasing. This is strictly increasing.
Dr. Levinovich?
Yes.
For the strictly decreasing, shouldn't it switch?
The last part. Yes, it should. Oh, yeah. Rather than.
It should switch to
the signs.
Yes, it should. Yeah. Yeah, when you see that kind of nonsense, you got to call me on it. Don't delay. Yeah, fix that. Thank you. I like to sometimes just be lazy and use fewer strokes when writing, so that's why I have a little northeast arrow, shall we say. I'm thinking of the sequence going off to the right and it's, and increasing. I'm imagining graphing the sequence. And so then, as the sequence, as sort of time goes off to the right and the values of the sequence are represented on a vertical scale, then decreasing like that. Hence, my little abbreviation there. Okay. Let's do another sequence. This time I didn't give a formula for it. I just wrote a bunch of terms and
I think you can see the pattern. There's a 3, then it starts doing powers of 2 in order. Okay. Now, how would you describe this sequence? Is it increasing? Is it decreasing?
Strictly.
It begins to decrease and strictly increase.
Yes. So it's not increasing all the time. So it's not increasing and it's not decreasing. Right? If you have even one counterexample, right? If it strictly decreases even once, then we can't say the whole sequence is increasing. And of course, there are infinitely many counterexamples to it being a decreasing sequence. So if I ask you to prove the sequence is not increasing or not decreasing, all you have to do is find the one counterexample. But if I ask you to prove it is increasing or is decreasing, then you've got to prove somehow infinitely many things. You have to have some kind of argument that generalizes to all terms. Here's one. A little whimsical sequence. 2 twos, 4 fours, 8 eights, then 16 sixteens, etc. How would we describe this sequence?
Increasing.
I just had a question on the first one. Like, if we're writing a proof, like, can we skip all the, everything else if we just find that one counterexample? Or would you still have to continue?
In this example, all I need is the one counterexample.
Okay.
Right? 3 came before 2 in the sequence. 3 is strictly bigger than 2. Therefore, it is not an increasing sequence. And 2 comes before in the sequence. 2 is strictly less than 4. Therefore, it's not a decreasing sequence. So that's a very short proof.
I didn't bother to actually write any proofs there because, in some sense, the arguments here are almost too easy to prove. You know, the proof takes longer than just seeing it. It doesn't really add much insight.
But if you want to put in your notes, 3 is strictly greater than 2, therefore this sequence is not increasing, and 2 is strictly less than 4. Therefore, the sequence is not decreasing. There, you just wrote a very short proof. There's an appendix in the book on this. I think it's A3 or A2. Not B3. See some more counterexample proofs there. And what can I erase next? That board.
I took pictures of that board.
I tried to boot it into the operating system on the pen drive. Since I failed to log in the Windows operating system. This may or may not work. Agree with that. Okay.
sequence prep.
More sequence prep. Okay. Okay. A sequence is bounded above if it has an upper bound.
Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, yes, that's very helpful.
One new term in terms of another new term.
Well, okay, so we have to go a little bit deeper into the rabbit hole here. So what's an upper bound? Okay.
A real is an upper bound. Let's give this real a name.
B,
called B. A real is an upper bound of a sequence AN. Well, if you think of your real line as going vertical, right, then you have the terms in the sequence are somewhere on the real line, and this number B is supposed to be above them all, with the possibility that some of the terms in the sequence hit the B exactly, but none of them go above it. And again, it's one of those things where you're demanding something of the whole sequence. Okay. If there's even one counterexample, then your upper bound is broken. So let's look here. One is an upper bound of this. And what else can we say about it? Well, two-thirds is not an upper bound because there's one term bigger than two-thirds. The one that gets as close to the sequence as possible, right, while still being an upper bound. But you could have a slack upper bound. It doesn't get as close as it could to the sequence, but it's still above the sequence. The issue is, all of these numbers, 1 over 1, 1 over 2, 1 over 3, all of them are less than or equal to 1. There's a number here that is not less than or equal to a half, namely 1 over 1. And all of these numbers, the reciprocals, are less than or equal to 2 as well. So you've got some upper bounds. And there are also numbers that are not upper bounds. And as long as you have at least one upper bound, you're bounded above. So to prove that something is bounded above, you've got to give me an upper bound. Usually, you can actually come up with an explicit number, like 1 or 3 or whatever, and prove that's the upper bound. Sometimes, when it's really tricky, you can't do that, and you have some kind of non-constructive proof that makes some argument, well, I don't know what the upper bound is, but for such and such reasons, I can prove that there is an upper bound. But usually, we can actually come up with a particular number.
Yeah, I think something's happening here. X fill to start. I'm not going to get the spreadsheet. Yes, maybe. X is the graphical user interface on that operating system. So, well, that was fun, but I'm going to have to call OIT. Pellegrino 204, and the computer there won't let me or anyone else log in. I suspect it's not connected to the network. Thank you very much. Questions, comments. You all seen this before? It's new. Okay. Who's seen some of this before?
I saw it in the book.
Saw it in the book. All right, Brad. Keep up the good work. Keep reading. Okay. Looks like these batteries didn't do so well over the summer. Limited shelf life. They're sitting in the camera. Non-trivial sequence is we'll prove two things about it. We're going to prove a sequence is increasing and bounded above. Here we go. There's my sequence. And if you like your sigma notation from calculus 2, you can write something like this. Okay. So this sequence is just partial sums of a geometric series.
So does anybody remember a formula for the limit of those? If you do know, we're going to pretend we don't know, and we're going to figure it out. At one point in this, there will be a little clever algebraic trick that you can't come up with automatically. It's something where you have to think about it for a long time or see somebody else do the trick. So there'll be a little bit of magic in the proof. But aside from that one little bit of magic, it's all going to be kind of straightforward. You know, we need to prove increasing, and we need to prove bounded of. I claim the sequence is bounded above and increasing. Proof. Okay.
Would you like the projector answer?
Yes, I would. So you logged in fine?
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't log in earlier.
Would you like the screen down?
Yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
Did you log into students or the TAMI domain or?
Oh no. Well, whenever you restart the computer, it logs in by itself.
It does.
Yep.
Okay. It was asking for a login.
Yeah.
So if I just restart it,
yeah,
I won't have to log in.
No.
All right, I'll do that.
Any more assistance?
No, it looks good.
Okay.
Thank you. All right.
We'll have a little demo in a minute.
Okay.
Here we go. So one of the ways to prove that something is increasing is to take differences. If you show that the differences are non-negative, that is greater than or equal to zero, then that means the sequence is increasing. What do we got? We've got our sequence all the way out to the n plus 1 power of the third. Right, that's the n plus 1 term of the sequence. We have this sum here. We're looking at sequence term n plus 1. Now I'm going to subtract off the nth term. And everything cancels except that one little power of the third at the very end here. Okay? 1 over 3 to the n plus 1 is greater than or equal to 0. So a sub n plus 1 is greater than or equal to a sub n. So that's how you know the sequence is increasing. Just do a little bit of algebra. You have to work with the definition of the sequence, and the argument had to be general, right? I had to do an argument that didn't depend on which particular n I was looking at. And what I've shown is that each term in the sequence is greater than or equal to the term that came before it. So if I turn things around, right, I plug in 0 here, right? Term a sub 0 is less than or equal to term a sub 0 plus 1, which is just a1, right? Which in turn is less than or equal to a sub 1 plus 1. Right? Which is A2, which in turn is less than or equal to A sub 2 plus 1, which is A3. So you see, by just proving this statement here, which it works for all n, right? I didn't assume anything about this number n, I just showed you this general pattern. That's how I can actually prove that the whole thing is increasing. So So the sequence is increasing. You can clearly see that if I wanted to prove it was strictly increasing, I could have done it, right? I could have observed that 1 over 3 to the n plus 1 is strictly greater than 0, and then I would have gotten a strict inequality here. So the minor algebraic trick, this is not the magic trick, the easy algebraic trick, you guys see a bunch of stuff added together. So if you want to compare things that are added together, subtraction is a natural thing to try. So you subtract them and you see which one is bigger. In this case, the thing that added up more positive terms is the bigger one. Any questions about that? There are other tricks that come in, like instead of subtracting, if you have positive terms in the sequence, you can divide them. And if the quotient is bigger than 1, then you know the numerator is bigger, right? There are various tricks. Now, bounded above, that's where you need a little magic. Here's the little bit of algebraic magic here. Take 1 minus a third times the nth term of the sequence. Which is the sum of all these powers of a third. So that's the secret. It's not obvious that I should have done that, but it's going to work. I've seen other people do this trick for the geometric series. Okay. So that's a little magic trick here. It doesn't look like it's going to help me yet, but let's see. Okay, it's getting kind of hard to read with all the fractions and so on. So let's make this a little easier. Let's have a name for a third. Now it's going to look nice. It's going to be 1 minus r times r to the 0 plus r to the 1 plus r to the 2 and so on. Okay. Now it's just a polynomial. Because we're thinking of the powers of a third instead of reciprocals of powers of 3. So treat it like a polynomial. Use the distributive property here. What are we going to have? We'd have 1 times all this stuff minus r times all this stuff. So we're just going to do algebra. Okay. So now that's 1 times each of the terms. Now look at negative r times each of the terms. So negative r times r to the 0, so that's r to the 1. And r to the 0 is just 1, r to the 1 is just r. I'm writing out the exponent to just keep the pattern matching here. Negative r times r, or r to the 1, is negative r squared. Right? Then there's going to be negative r times an r squared, negative r cubed. I'm going to divide that one. No,
r cubed.
And then it should be all minuses. Eventually we get towards the end of this sum. Now we have negative r times r to the n minus 2. Negative r to the n minus 1. As a result of that multiplication. Then we have negative r times r to the n minus 1. That's negative r to the n. Finally, we have negative r times r to the n. So we get negative r to the n plus 1. And now you can see where the cancellation happens. The first power of r here gets canceled.
second power of R here gets canceled. This cubed R term, it gets canceled with a cubed R term up here that I just left out, but it's in the dot, dot, dots. This R to the N minus 2, it gets canceled with a negative R to the N minus 2 that's down here in the dot, dot, dots. And so do all the terms in between it. There's an R to the fifth in between. It occurs as a positive and as a negative. They cancel. Everything gets canceled all the way up to R to the N. But there's a very last term that doesn't get canceled. So after all that cancellation, thanks to this inspired choice here, multiplying by 1 minus a third, 1 minus r of the rotation, we get this. Okay? So if you take 1 minus a third times any term in the sequence, you get a number like this. 1 minus a power of a third. Okay? So that's smaller than 1. All I really need is that it's smaller than or equal to 1. So, 1 minus a third times an is less than or equal to 1. Well, that's just 2 thirds, right? Multiply this inequality by 3 halves, and you conclude that every term in the sequence is less than or equal to 3 halves. So that's what we need to prove an upper bound. We need to show that there's some actual number greater than or equal to everything in the sequence. In actuality, this sequence actually converges to 3 halves. Prove the convergence, but we did prove that the sequence is increasing and bounded above. It's never going to get bigger than 3 halves. Okay. Questions or comments about this proof? What matters is that I wrote a sub n is less than or equal to something. Right? So if I had a sequence that was always negative 5 point something or other, then negative 5 would be an upper bound.
Oh.
Yeah. If you wanted to prove a lower bound of this sequence, that would be much easier. All the terms in the sequence are positive. So, for example, 0 is an easy lower bound. So I was going to kind of have a little fun here talking about how the reals aren't really real. Okay, so you probably believe in the associative property of addition. It doesn't matter in which order you add stuff. Okay.
All right, so for example, let's have some numbers here. 1, negative 1, and 0.1. Okay. And then here is a few things to look at. So we could look at x plus y. So we'll add those two first, then we'll add z. Plus y to z. Okay, now we do things the other way. X and y plus z. And then x plus y plus z. And it comes out the same. Great, addition is associative. All right, but let's show you that Excel doesn't have any actual real numbers. Okay, it has a finite number system. It can't handle the full infinite nature of the real line here. Okay, so far everything's good. Let me use a little notation here. This means 10 to the minus 3. Okay, so just 0.001. How about 10 to the minus 14? Okay, these two are still equal. Yeah. Okay, but let's see. 10 to the minus 15. Oh, they're not the same anymore. Here it says 0 is that, okay? There. I broke associativity. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. That's not quite small enough to break it. Still not quite small enough to break it. Still. So I get down to here, then it breaks. What the computer has is an approximately associative addition because it's working with approximate real numbers. Now, new sheet here. Now, for your homework, I gave you this sequence that's defined recursively, yeah? I give you a formula that says, given the nth term of the sequence, how do I get the next one? Follow the formula. So here's what that sequence looks like in decimal notation. Okay, so the first term is just 5, I think. And then, let's follow what the homework says. It says to take the previous term, square it, add 5, divide by twice the previous term. Okay, that's what it does. What I'm actually using here is something called Newton's method. This is a common way that computers actually figure out square roots. Okay, the sequence converges, and very rapidly, I might add, to the square root of 5. You see, after just a few iterations, it's got all the decimal places you care to see correct of the square root of 5. Or at least you hope it's correct because they're stabilizing, and hopefully it's stabilizing on the square root of 5. I think we could have a whole bunch more decimal places, maybe. This is maybe if you want to see a little bit more. Let's see. It offers 30 decimal places, but you see it doesn't really use them. Somewhere around 10 to the minus 15, it's not telling you the truth. But but yeah. So the sequence does converge to the square root of 5. I'm not asking you to prove that in your homework. What I'm asking you to do is prove that the sequence, if you look closely,
see, this sequence is supposed to be decreasing. Yes, it's decreasing. I had to squint at it for a moment. But if you look closely, you see that the terms are decreasing. And so what I'm asking you to do with this sequence is to prove it's decreasing and prove it's bounded below. So kind of a mirror image of the thing we did here. Here I proved increasing and bounded above. This sequence, you're going to prove it's decreasing and bounded below. On Monday, we're going to talk more about some topics related to how you prove this kind of stuff. But I mean, what I've been doing today is correlated with chapter 1 in the textbook. We're going to talk about some stuff correlated with chapter 2 next time. And let's see. I don't know. And I have a photographic board here, so I can erase this. Why do we care about increasing and bounded above or decreasing and bounded below? Because those kinds of sequences are guaranteed to converge. All right? So, let's see here. Here's a decimal definition of convergence, okay? There's a few words you could use if there's choices, right? You could say it converges to a real number L, or maybe you'd like to say, maybe you like to use the word limit, right? As limit L, if what? If L has a decimal representation, such that each digit of L eventually matches the corresponding digits, the corresponding digit of AN. So it might not match at first, but eventually you get far enough out into the sequence and then it does match. And keeps matching. So the idea is it might not match at first, and maybe there's a time when it matches, but then later it breaks again, but eventually it'll stop being wrong, okay?
That'd be a pithy way to describe it.
We'll define convergence without talking about decimals next time. We'll use the epsilon type characterization.
Okay.
Now, see, what's an example of this? Here's a sequence. 1.9, 1.99, 1.999, 1.9999, 1.9999, and so on. And this sequence has limit 2. Why? Because you can write 2 in this decimal representation. And in this representation of 2, every decimal place eventually stops being wrong. At the beginning, this digit is correct, but all the others are wrong, right? Because 1 is 1.000. But once you get to the second term, now you've got 2 of the digits correct. And then the third term will have 3 of the digits correct. And what's more, there's no backsliding, right? Eventually, a digit gets correct, and then it stays correct in all the later terms. So the convergence or limits is about stability, right? Eventually, stuff stabilizes. And, written myself into a corner. I got a little punchline in the last 60 seconds or something. Okay. So, what's nice about the real line is that, as I said, if a sequence is increasing and it's bounded above, then it converges to some thing, right? Unless you tell me more about the sequence, I can't tell you what it converges to. But I can tell you that if it's really increasing and bounded above, then it converges to something. Okay? And the mirror image fact is also true. If a sequence is decreasing and is bounded below, which would be the mirror image, meaning you have a lower bound, a number that's under all the terms in the sequence, right? Then again, it has a limit. It converges. I don't know what it converges to unless you tell me more about the sequence. And even then, I still might not know. But I know it converges to something. And the argument is just, okay, if it's, say it's increasing, but bounded above, well, the integer part can't increase forever, because if it did, it'd go off to infinity. It can't strictly increase forever. The integer part has to stabilize, right? Because it's going to bump into that upper bound eventually. And then after the integer part stabilizes, look at the first decimal place. Well, there's only 10 things it could be, 0 through 9. Okay? That can't increase forever, right? Because you've got this upper bound. So again, it stabilizes eventually. And then you look at the hundredths place. Again, you've got this upper bound. You can't increase the hundredths place forever, or eventually you'll shoot past the upper bound. So eventually the hundredths place has to stabilize. Then the thousandths place. Again, you increase it forever. Strictly, it's going to eventually shoot past your upper bound. Right? If your upper bound is a million, and you increase the thousandths place forever, right? All you need is a billion steps starting from zero to get past. So every digit eventually has to stabilize if you're increasing the bound above. Book's got a nice little version of that argument too. It's not a formal proof because we're not going to be focusing on decimals after today. We're going to focus more on the epsilon version of things. So just take this thing, which the book calls the completeness property, take it as an axiom. Okay? An axiom of the real number line. If this property was not true, then that would mean we weren't working with anything I'd be willing to call real numbers. Okay? And that definitely puts us out of time, so thank you for your patience. And I will see you Monday. I have office hours on Thursday, too. Yes? I'll see. If I assign some homework on day two, I'll put what it's due. So far, it's just this thing due on day five. I haven't scheduled all the due dates of homework in advance, because I'm not sure when it should be done. Thank you.